All right, our special guest today is financial advisor Ben Utley, CFP. Ben is the founder of Physician Family Financial Advisors Incorporated. This is a multi-specialty team of fiduciary financial advisors for physicians who is serving 175 doctors from coast to coast. They're flat fee advisors based out of Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us why you became a financial planner.
Basically, I wanted to help people. So years and years ago, I was a chemist. That was my original training. And it wasn't close enough to people. And I thought I was giving myself cancer. So I was in a lab with a guy who was an investor. And so we got to talk about investing. And one day I found myself in the library reading the Value Line and the Morningstar. And I checked out all the Kiplingers and all the money magazines. And that was fascinating. And so I got my master's degree instead of my PhD, bailed out, volunteered at Consumer Credit Counseling Service, and enjoyed that. Met somebody who worked at Waddell & Reed. Went there, was exposed to the sales culture, found that really icky, decided I could run my own shop. And that's when it started. You know, I just started working with folks. Initially, I specialized in a couple different areas. I tried some of those. And I was referred by one of my original clients to a physician who was just lovely. She's still with me today, almost 25 years later, and just fell in love. I mean, I like what physicians do, enjoy the healthcare space. And, you know, my science background comes into the field there. So I served her well. She married a guy who is also a surgeon. I had to destroy my practice and rebuild it to make both of them happy. You know, he referred me to somebody who was in his practice, who was married to somebody in another practice, who knew somebody in that practice. It just kind of kept going and going until I looked back through about 10 generations of word of mouth, all the way back to that car dealer who I originally hooked cold calling on a Sunday. And so we got to a point where we had a number of physicians, where it was about 50%. I renamed the practice with search terms, physician, financial advisors. I knew that family was important, so I threw that in there. And today, you know, we're 175 physicians strong in about 30 states. There's five people on our team, including myself. And it's all docs, with the exception of three or four people who have been with me since way before I rebranded.
Now, that's a really high percentage, even for a practice that specializes in doctors, to have that many of the clients be doctors. What other aspects of your practice are unique?
I think that the way that we bill is very unique. It is a flat fee subscription model. It's not based on how much money you have. It's not based on how much money you earn. It's not based on how many doctors there are in the household. It is simply the client has a relationship with myself and the team through the firm, and we bill in proportion to the value that we believe that we can bring, and we kind of average that across all clients. So it's the same level monthly fee, and those fees are present on the homepage of our website in 36-point font.
36-point font, to make sure nobody misses it.
Nobody misses it. Yeah, I don't want anybody to call us and say like, oh, what do you charge? It's on the homepage. No, it's fully disclosed, so there's no conflicts of interest.
You know, it's almost a truism in financial advice that if you can't find the fee structure on the website, it's either a bad fee structure or you're paying too much.
That's true.
All right. Well, we want to get into some questions from the listeners, and I thought we'd keep you on and let's talk about a few of them. Our first one is on a popular subject, Bitcoin. This one comes from Sam the Intern. Let's take a listen to it.
Hey, Dr. Dolly, this is Sam the Intern. I have a quick theoretical question for you about Bitcoin. I personally haven't really drunk the Kool-Aid of this being a good asset class to invest in, but a friend pointed out an interesting mathematical curiosity to me. It seems to me that if you were to take advantage of its hyper-volatility, you could rebalance your portfolio by selling when it's high, buying when it's low, and overall increasing your net returns, not based on the asset class itself appreciating in value, but based on its ability to be volatile and to utilize that in the other aspects of your portfolio. How do you feel about that? Is that just trying to overly complicate things, or is that a decent strategy to manipulate the volatility of this this asset class? Thanks for all you do.
Okay, there's an interesting question. Ben, why don't you take a stab at that, and then I'll give my thoughts on it.
Well, philosophically, I believe that invested money is like soap. The less you touch it, the more you keep. And I'm thinking of a strategy that rebalances based on the, you know, monthly, daily, weekly, hourly price movements of something as volatile as Bitcoin. That's kind of a strategy. It's going to be really hard to keep your hands off the money. I find that the more often you touch it, the more mistakes you make, the more transaction costs, the more taxes you pay. It's very much kind of not a passive approach. And, you know, I also see you know, if we look at this in terms of modern portfolio theory, where you hold a basket of assets that have inverse or negative or no correlations, you know, that's the theory, but I don't want to own an asset class that has a zero expected return. And it's hard to say that Bitcoin has a zero expected return, but for me, an investment is something that has the inherent ability to accrue value, like in terms of rent streams or dividends or interest, without respect to the owner's involvement. So I don't see Bitcoin as an investment. I see it more like a gold coin or like a US currency. It's a store of value for sure, but for me, it's not an investment. And as a result, I wouldn't put it in my portfolio or recommend it.
Yeah, even as a store of value, it's pretty volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The underlying this question is something that I think we ought to point out as perhaps fallacy, which is the idea that you know when it's high and you know when it's low.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you know that for any asset class, particularly Bitcoin. For example, if your plan is to trade this, you know, selling it when it's 30,000 or selling it when it's 60,000 and buying it when it's 30,000, and then it goes to 15,000. Well, what do you do now? Right? You just bought it at 30,000 and now it's 15,000. And so I think there's a bit of assumption there that you're going to be able to predict the future as far as its price movements when you implement a plan like this. I'm not a big fan of time in the market, whether it's stocks or bonds or Bitcoin. And this strategy obviously requires that. Now, obviously, if you could do that, you could buy low and sell high. Yeah, you're going to make a killing on something this volatile because you could do it so often. But I'm just, I'd reject the hypothesis that you can actually do it. I don't think you can. And I agree with you. I think it's more an instrument of speculation than it is a real investment.
Yeah, not for me. I'm the rock solid financial security guy. I don't like to play with these things. I mean, my hat is off to those who have managed to do this well. And I am really interested in blockchain technology, but I think this is just the nascent thing in blockchain technology. I doubt that this is its highest and best use. I know that that's coming. And so, yeah, it's going to be like the internet, but I don't see Bitcoin. I don't see crypto as an investment unto itself. I mean, don't buy the gold, buy the picks and shovels.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The last article I read about it this morning, it had gone apparently in 24 hours from $29,000 a Bitcoin to $39,000 a Bitcoin, based on the fact that Amazon dropped a job listing looking for a cryptocurrency expert. And it's just amazing that something can change by 33% because one company hired one person. And that is just way too volatile for me to put serious money into.
Yeah.
All right, let's take our next question. This one's from Paul. It's about passive and actively managed bond funds.
Hello, Dr. Dolly. You have been a very positive influence on my financial health, and I thank you. The case for passive over active management of the stock portion of a portfolio is very strong and has been discussed many times. My question is passive versus active management of one's bond allocation. Bonds are a different animal than stocks, and I am interested in your thoughts on this. Is comparing active management of a stock fund and a bond fund an apples and oranges type of thing? Specifically, I have been looking at PIMCO's bond ETF versus Vanguard's BND ETF. Bond's expense ratio of 0.55% is significantly higher than BND's ER of 0.035%. However, I'm interested if you think having the active expertise of bonds managers might be worth the added expense. Thank you.
All right, Paul, that's a great question. Ben, you want to talk about your thoughts on actively managed bond funds?
My take on bonds in general is that they're kind of the anchor to windward for an all-stock portfolio. They're the thing that gives you a buffer. And, you know, we want that buffer to be relatively secure. We want it to be relatively stable, and we want it to be there when we need it. So, you know, in terms of active versus passive, I don't know that that's really the question that I'd be asking. It's more like, is it going to be there or is it not going to be there? And here's an example. Back in 2008, the Oregon College Savings Plan had an Oppenheimer bond fund in it, actively managed. And they made the wrong bet, and it blew up, and that fund irrevocably lost a whole bunch of money. And that happened at a time when you want that bonds to be there to buffer the stock market corrections that we had. So for me, it's not really whether active or passive is better in terms of long-run results. It's more like the operator error. It's the risk that you get that this manager will make an irrecoverable mistake. And I feel like that irrecoverable mistake happens in large quantity, and it's somewhat likely. So as a result, that outweighs any marginal return that you would get above and beyond traditional bond funds. Now, in this particular case, comparing the PIMCO bond fund to, you know, a Vanguard ETF, is you really are comparing apples and oranges. I mean, if you look at the top 10 holdings of this particular bond fund, you see in there that they have a preferred stock. So it's not true bond exposure. PIMCO is known to use leverage and derivatives, which is kind of part of their strategy. I'm not faulting that, but I'm saying that's very different than what you're going to get in a Vanguard bond, you know, total bond market index. It's apples and oranges. And I wouldn't expect similar performance out of them. So I couldn't even begin to compare them regardless of the huge difference in the operating expense ratio.
Yeah, you've got to look under the hood. That's the most important thing with an investment, is what are you actually investing in?
Right.
And if you're buying preferred stocks and you think they're bonds, well, preferred stocks do not perform the same as bonds, for sure. The other thing you got to keep in mind is your expenses matter a lot more with a bond fund, because the yields, especially these days, are not very high, you know. 50 basis points is a big chunk of your return to pay to an active manager. But I agree with you. The big issue I have with active management is the manager risk. You know, yes, you've got in the long run, you know, you got this 10% chance of beating the index, but that's just not worth the 90% chance of underperforming the index in my book. And then you got to watch the manager, and when the fund manager retires and they get a new one, now you got to watch that one and decide if you want to stick with that one. I'd rather just set it and forget it. So I'm a big fan of passive management, both on the bond and the stock side.
The math that makes index funds work also makes bond funds work. It also makes emerging markets work. It's the same math. You know, collectively, all the managers are going to own all the market. And they're going to get the average less the cost of their management. So, I mean, generally active management is just, it's a losing proposition. It looks great in the short run, but in the long run, it just never looks as good as indexes.
Absolutely. I agree. All right. Let's go on to our next question. This one comes from Modi. He's asking about social index funds and investing in them. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Jim. This is Mo. Thank you for all you do and the amount of research you do on our questions. I have a question around social index fund investing. I've been looking at the various Vanguard funds around this, and first starting with the VFTNX index fund for socially conscious investing. This is a fund that's been around since 2003. It has a $5 million minimum investment, so none of us are going to be investing in it. But it seems to have strong returns over the last two decades. In fact, when I look, I think it might actually be beating the total stock market index fund as well. And so I know I can't invest in this one, but I look at the one I could invest in, the Vanguard VFTAX social index fund, and that one's only been around 2 years or so. So would appreciate your opinion on how those two social index funds are different, or how they're investing differently from each other versus similarly. Know obviously that crystal balls are going to be cloudy no matter what fund it is, but as long as the evidence is not pointing that these are so much worse, I think a number of docs and other folks might be interested in this route of investing ongoing. Thanks so much.
All right, good question. One I'm getting more and more frequently, whether you call them social indexes or whether you call them ESG funds, I think is the most common term these days. There's a lot of interest people have in promoting good governance and social equity and helping the environment while they invest. What are your thoughts on these funds and maybe those Vanguard offerings in particular, Ben?
Well, I like the idea of investing things that you feel good about, because money should feel good when you're doing it right. In this particular case, I think the reason there's been outperformance in the last 10 years is when you take the things that are socially icky, like oil companies, out of the index, then you know it's more concentrated in the things that have won in the last 10 years. So technology has been really hot in the last couple years, and over the last 10 years, oil has performed poorly. And so if you drop that out of the total index to get this social index, then you're going to have a greater concentration of the things that have been working in the last 10 years. I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that this is a social fund and it's a good fund or a bad fund. I think it has everything to do with the sector exposure. Another thought is, you know, let's say that maybe you're in your 401k and you don't have access to the social index, but you want to do something good. You're more or less forced to invest in just a straight up index. But you know, in terms of really making a difference in the world that we live in, whether or not you own oil is not going to make a huge difference, because those companies are going to be in existence. They're going to trade on the exchanges, whether you like it or not. They're out there. It's your investment in a fund is not going to change that, because these securities already exist. What will change is if you become actively involved in a charitable organization where you go and you use your own hands or you use your own money. Maybe take the money that you make in the index, you know, maximize the amount of money that you're going to make, and then go donate that to charity, or, you know, donate time to charity. Get actively involved. You'll make a far bigger difference there than you will by messing around with, you know, which share class you have and whether or not they're socially performance.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of social investing. And it's not that I don't like the environment. I don't like, you know, bad governance or social causes. Part of the issue with these funds is it's hard to find one that lines up with your thoughts on all of these hot political topics. You know, you might not care about oil, but you care about guns. Or you might not care about guns. You might be the biggest NRA supporter in the country, but you really want to see, you know, corporate managers held to their tasks. And it's really hard to find a fund that actually lines up with your beliefs. I think that's challenge number one, if you want to do this. And challenge number two, I think, is what you mentioned, that, you know, it doesn't make that big of a difference. And I think you're far better off earning money as best you can, you know, perhaps not, you know, starting your own company that, you know, you're against, but certainly investing broadly in the U.S. market, and then using your money to donate to the charities that you support. That's what Katie and I do. We don't try to, you know, have fancy social index funds. We just have boring old total stock market funds, and then we donate to charity, both with our time and our money. So I'm not a big fan of social index fund investing. The good news is I think the data a number of years ago was that they substantially underperformed. More recently, it looks a little better. I agree. The reason for that is that they're heavier on tech stocks than they are on more value companies, which have underperformed over the last decade. But maybe they're getting better at actually providing reasonable returns. I think the governance factor in particular is promising in that regard.
I wouldn't expect that outperformance to keep going. You know, I mean, it's one thing to go and talk to your congressperson in person and talk with them about how you feel about these positions and issues and to be actively involved. It's another thing to not use a straw, you know, because it's made out of plastic. I mean, really, I mean, I think it's okay to invest socially, but don't use it as a cop-out. You know, use it as something that's added on top of the other activities that you're pursuing to actually make a change rather than just feel like you're making a change.
Well said. All right. Well, Ben, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. For those who are interested in learning more about Ben, maybe hiring him to help you with your finances, you can find that firm at physicianfamily.com. It's very easy. They got their fees right on the website. They got their people right on the website. There's a big button in the upper right-hand corner, Get Started. And they can get you hooked up there. That's physicianfamily.com. Ben Utley, CFP, thanks for coming on here.
Hey, just want to say, we also have a podcast, Physician Family Financial Advisors Podcast. So if you're a physician and with kids, maybe you're a physician mom or a doctor dad, give us a listen. We're everywhere you can find podcasts.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that.
My pleasure.